Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Big hour coming your way. Anthony Munoz, the best offensive lineman ever, former Super Bowl finalist, didn't win it all. He'll be joining us. We like to get him every year at the Super Bowl. Super Bowl 60, a couple of days away. Not there. Usually I get there, but it's not going to work out this time. And, of course, we have a lot going on today. We'll expect a press conference with Savannah Guthrie's mom, about 1 o'clock Eastern time today. Also, the president's delivering remarks at his National Prayer Breakfast. And I would say this. We were carrying it. He was running a little bit late. And so far, he has not really gone to the teleprompter. He's kind of working the room, and he's hysterical. So, but he's having some fun there. I think he's going to talk about the way his administration is standing up, stood up at that St. Paul Church, and made sure that everybody that broke into that church to harass people in that church over in Minneapolis were going to have hell to pay, including Don Lemon. I think the president's going to bring that up. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We see people taking advantage of loopholes in the law and operating these illegal labs with these pathogens, as we've discussed, from malaria to HIV. And that really is a threat to the security of the United States.
This story is not getting enough coverage. Killer Chinese bio labs uncovered in Las Vegas and Los Angeles, and Red China is financing it. Question, why did the last FBI director play it down? And why are we no longer making China our number one enemy on our strategy?
Number two.
These are the types of numbers that should really worry Republicans. Okay, Republicans' margins in Texas. Trump won it by 14 points. But look at the generic ballot, the generic House ballot. Now we're talking about a Republican advantage of just 1-2 points.
That's pretty scary in Texas. Politics aplenty. A major announcement from Kamala today. I don't know what it is, as the GOP realizes they're getting a Hispanic wake-up call before the midterms, although the money keeps flowing into their coffers.
Number one.
Mr. President, speaking of Minneapolis, what did you learn?
I learned that maybe we can use a little bit of a softer touch, but you still have to be tough.
That is true. The President of the United States putting things back together the right way in Minneapolis. As the president admits he needed a course correction in his illegal immigrant sweep. What does that mean for other cities with Tom Homan in charge? I think it's a good tone and time to correct things with 9 months left into the midterm elections. And you got to bring up something else, too. The midterm elections, and in 5 days, you could have another government shutdown. But let's go back to Minneapolis for a second. So yesterday, we kind of covered it here, brought in some sound bites from Tom Homan's presser there, decreasing 700 ICE agents. Okay. A lot of Border Patrol. So 700 from 3,000 down 2,000. Okay. But that's not going to make everyone happy. What are you talking about? They're going to gradually scale back on the amount of officers. That's what he says. So that's exactly what he promised. That's exactly what he's delivering. Behind closed doors, that's exactly what he's trying to do. Tom Homan, I'm going to talk to you guys. The last, Christine Ohm wasn't. the mayor, the governor, not talking. I'm going to be talking to you guys. I'm going to scale this back. Going to forget about politics. Tom Holman, I worked for six presidents, including Barack Obama, a lot of Democratic presidents. I'm not political. I'm just here to enforce the immigration laws. So they get a positive, you would think a positive situation where he praised local officials, especially the sheriffs in the suburbs. But there's Mayor Jacob Frey hopping on CNN, not happy, cut 10.
Obviously, there is a de-escalatory element if you are decreasing the number of agents that are on the street. That being said, when you have 2,000 agents that are still here, approximately 20 times that which we had prior to Operation Metro Surge, that, relatively speaking, no, is not a de-escalation.
It is a de-escalation. And the problem is they're surging in different areas and scooping up thousands of illegal immigrant criminals. You might want to take a picture of a five-year-old and you'd say, well, with a cute hat on, you feel bad for the kid. But if your dad's here illegally and committed a crime, he's going to be scooped up. I still want to get to the answers on that. But people pointing to those situations, not the criminals they scooped up. I wish one person could turn around and say, Tom Holman got criminals off our streets in our neighborhoods. We had no idea how bad this guy was living right next to us. Here's Tom Holman, cut 9.
President Trump made a promise of mass deportation. I made a promise of mass deportation. And it's happening. And it's continued happening for the next 3 years. We're not slowing down. As President Trump has said, worst first. But if you're in the country legally, you're not off the table.
So what we have, and I just want you to understand this. Metro Surge has arrested 4,000 illegal immigrants, murderers, sex offenders, gang members. You could go see the police blotter. You could see these people. If you are a politician that wants to get things done and make things safer, let's say you're left wing or extreme right wing. Right wing wants everybody out. Left wing wants everyone to stay. You have to say, pretty glad, you know, crime is down, record lows. We are about 200 to 300 cops shy. But we have 4,000 illegal immigrant criminals taken out. Thanks for that. But let's say you know, my neighbor, my soccer coach, overstayed his visa. I got this handyman working on construction. I got a construction company. 5 of the 50 people there are here illegally. Work real hard. They're upstanding citizens. I wish you'd leave them alone. That's the type of conversation I would have. Thanks for getting the criminals out. But can you have a separate standard for people to maybe get extended work visas away now that you've taken charge and will be in charge for the next 3 years to get them to stay? And by the way, this is the one president could actually do immigration reform, because he's done the impossible. The impossible was sealing the border. I could not even have this conversation till the border was sealed. I never thought he could do it in the matter of months, but he never got the appreciation for it because he did it so quickly and it seemed so effortless. So let's talk politics if we can. And by the way, if we get any highlights.
Brian, we have Kamala's big announcement.
We have it right now?
You want to hear it?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Madam Vice President, what's going on with Kamala HQ?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I have good news. So Kamala HQ is turning into headquarters, and it's where you can go online to get basically the latest of what's going on, and also to meet and revisit with some of our great courageous leaders, be they elected leaders, community leaders, civic leaders, faith leaders, young leaders. I'm really excited about it. So stay engaged, and I'll see you out there. Thank you.
So that was put online? That was her big announcement?
That's her big announcement.
So she's going to have a headquarters. So a lot of times people want to say before they jump in, I'm doing a listening tour. I'm having an exploratory committee. She's going, I'm going to be Kamala HQ.
Or not even Kamala HQ. It's just where you can go, basically, if you're a young Democrat, you can go there to get all your news, because I'm sure it's going to be completely
unbiased. She wants a website.
Yeah, essentially, that we can't even get to yet because it's blocked. But yeah, it's a block, and you can listen to like up and coming leaders, I'm assuming on the left, and you know, where you should be thinking and all important news like that. That was the big announcement. That is not what you expected.
Not what I expected. I thought there was going to be, I'm trying to get ahead of everybody and just make it clear that if you're going to run, I'm going to have X amount of dollars, this type of support, and I'm out there first.
Nope.
Everybody's laughing.
So I actually thought that you had something from late night television or something.
No, that was the real. You're like, is this real? I'm like, no, we're giving you, like, this is all AI generated. We're making a
because
news.
I don't know. You came in, your back was hurting. I don't know if you took some drugs and then maybe really? You just thought you'd interrupt the show. But I think Eric would stop you before you could actually do something. All right. So that was real. That is the big announcement. That's what we waited 24 hours for.
It is.
All right.
I can't believe all those thoughts went through your head that I took drugs.
Because I literally was talking and you said, Brian.
Well, because you went on to politics and it was one of our big three, the big tease that she had breaking news. And then it broke within the last few minutes. So I thought I'd bring you the breaking news. Not that you would think I was taking drugs.
No, I'm not saying for sure you're taking drugs, but I wouldn't rule it out. Legal drugs. By the way, I do think a leave works best.
For back problems, yes, you did give me that advice.
Right, because I think it focuses on swelling.
I will let you know when I take it.
Okay. So, on the left, Gavin Newsom, was just finishing off the Democratic Party. I just think this is absolutely hysterical what the California Business Association did with Gavin Newsom. So they have a Times Square. They took out an ad right in Times Square, which, by the way, it really, like, you go into Times Square now, it used to be big signs and things. And now they're all electronic. It really catches your attention. But now that Kamala HQ, that big news is officially announced. Gavin Newsom, I think he's got to deal with this. Gavin Newsom took a hit from what they're saying is the California Business and Industrial Alliance. They show Gavin Newsom wearing a Jets jersey saying record is worse than the Jets. Now, the Jets were 3-14 this year. And what they're referring to is something real. When it comes to homelessness, they're number one. When it comes to debt, they're number one. When it comes to the amount of people leaving a state, they're number one. When it comes to gas prices and taxes, they're number one. Illegal immigrants, they're number one. They now have a huge deficit when they used to have a surplus. That is Gavin Newsom's record. And I think that's pretty cool. Now you have Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom, who I think gradually will eventually be going at each other, which would be fantastic. Now, before we take a break, I want to just talk about what's happening on the right. And they're getting away. Wake up call, big time. Because if you look at what's happening with the Hispanic vote, we look what happened to special elections. If you saw what happened in the state race in Texas, yeah, the outcome is pretty consistent. The president of the United States has done more for the Republican Party in getting the Hispanic vote than anyone else. But it seems as though the extreme way in which one of the things is the extreme way in which he's going about rounding up the worst of the worst. They're not the worst of the worst, the roving caravans. However it's being represented, it's not resonating in the Hispanic community. Now, when the crackdown on the border, that was resonating. And that did win him people over because he knew it wasn't just about him. We saw the Chinese coming through there, people from Laos, Kazakhstan. They knew it wasn't maybe predominantly because the location, Central and South America, there was Hispanics. But the president wasn't coming down on them because they were Hispanics. They were coming down on them because of the because they're just breaching our border illegally. But here is Senator Tim Scott, who's in charge of this reelection for the Republicans. And he's noticing some problems. And Texas is where there is a problem. Here he is, cut 16.
I've said 2026 is a year of affordability. And the great news is President Trump has been producing time and time again. Let me give you three examples. Everyone who's listening to me, if you earn tips, you worked overtime, you're on Social Security, do your taxes in January. Why? You'll have more money to spend. The economy becomes more affordable when you realize tax on tips, you have to do your taxes first to get the benefit. Overtime, do your taxes to get the benefit. Social Security, do your taxes, get the benefit. What does that mean? 2026 is shaping up to be the year where Donald Trump's activities, his actions, mm-hmm. the legislation we've passed shows up.
It has to. And I do think they got to do something else this year. But Howard Enten looked at Texas and sees what's going on there. The reddest of the red, 22.
Republicans have been hoping to squeeze out more Republican seats from that state with their redistricting efforts, right? These are the types of numbers that should really worry Republicans. Okay, Republicans margins in Texas. Trump won it by 14 points. But look at the generic ballot, the generic House ballot. Now we're talking about a Republican advantage of just 1-2 points. That was a big influence in terms of what happened in Texas 9. Yeah, they got a good candidate, but it was also the environment has shifted so much to the left, right? This looks a whole heck of a lot like what we saw in 2018 when Republicans barely won that House vote. You put this together with this, together with this, and all of a sudden you can see how Democrats can really get bring out a lot of seats from the big states, the blue ones in California and New York, and of course the red one historically in the state of Texas.
Yeah, we'll see how this goes, because the one thing the president could do is to reemphasize the fact that the Hispanic community, although not, they're not, you can't have a broad scope. The Cubans, very different from the, you know, Argentinians or Mexicans. You can't just say this is how Hispanics feel, like they like to do in the black community, which is not right either. But the one thing they can do is realize this is a family-oriented, religious-first culture. And I think that would work. Also, what the president did in Venezuela, that's going to be is going to be impressive. And if the president could go ahead and fulfill what he wants to do in Cuba and let that society, that communist country, collapse under its own weight, that'll certainly help him, along with what he said in his own words. And we'll discuss that more in a moment. And that is bit of a lighter touch when it comes to cracking down illegal immigrants. I think that'll go a long way too. All right, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. The president said something significant at the prayer breakfast. We'll bring it back to you. And we're waiting in a few hours on the latest on Savannah Guthrie's mom, who's still missing. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
By the time I hit my 50s, I'd learned a few things. Like how family is precious. Work can always wait. And 99% of people over 50 already have the virus that causes shingles. Not everyone at risk will develop it, but I did. The painful, blistering rash disrupted my life for weeks. Don't learn about your shingles risk the hard way. Talk to your doctor or pharmacist today. Sponsored by GSK.
His mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Mr. President, speaking of Minneapolis, what did you learn?
I learned that maybe we can use a little bit of a softer touch, but you still have to be tough. These are criminals. We're dealing with really hard criminals. But look, I've called the people. I've called the governor. I've called the mayor, spoke to them, had great conversations with them. And then I see them ranting and raving out there. Literally as though a call wasn't made. We've done a great job everywhere.
And what they're going to do is gradually scale it down. But I worry, and I think it's going to help. Let's say there's no more incidents in Minnesota. We get to next Friday. If they don't have some type of agreement on DHS, whatever they want, I mean, here's some of the things they brought up. They said you need judicial warrants to pursue anyone. That's never going to happen. It's impossible. You let 9 million people in, you think you're going to get 9 million warrants? Number two. Masks. They're not going to take their masks off. But I think a compromise would be you put the numbers, I guess all these law enforcement officers, men and women, they have their numbers there. You put that on in Velcro. So you have an ID number. Say, hey, I got a problem with that person. You take a picture of their number, whatever it is, you write it down, but you don't go and get their name and then dox them and go on their social media footprint. Follow me? So if you really have a problem with that officer, that's the only reason you want to bring that person forward. You want to go forward. If you want that person's name on their uniform, that means you actually want to dox them, get their name out there, and find out where their family lives. So the other thing that they want is get the masks off, no more roving patrols. I think that could be worked out. You know, it's going to be hard to enforce from Chuck Schumer's situation, but I think if you tell Tom Holman there's not going to be roving patrols, I don't think that anyone mandated roving patrols. I don't think that's a good move anyway. So I'm just going to assume if you're going to put that as one of your demands that you think it's happening. So let's just assume that you think it's happening. No, that's fine. So you have a few gains and you don't have any longer. Do you have Greg Bovino? Reportedly today, Bovino was an issue. They said until last week, he was overseeing everything, as you know. He pushed back on internal efforts to temper his aggressive approach, according to NBC. Bovino wanted to do large-scale immigration sweeps during September Operation Chicago. Todd Lyons, the acting director, pushed back. He said arrest only people known to federal agents ahead of time for their violations. According to correspondence, Lyons seemed intent that the CBP conduct targeted operations for at least 2 weeks before transitioning to full-scale immigration enforcement. That's a good idea. But evidently, Bovino said, no, I'm doing it my way. And he did it his way. So, you're seeing the problem. And also, Tom Homan clarified who's in command and who's reporting to who. Therefore, they're all moving on the same page now, despite being different branches of law enforcement.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Was the President of the United States just in the break on his prayer breakfast. He's having a great time. I mean, he's talking, you know, a lot about religion, a lot about what's going on, and he's a very friendly audience. It's the who's who of political heavyweights, and he's having a great time. He will not be going to the Super Bowl. I think he was the first president to ever attend a Super Bowl last year in New Orleans. This year, he's not going to go out to San Francisco. 3,000 miles has a lot to do with it. Other people say, well, he doesn't want to go, but he's not going to get booed. He's going to get booed. Well, all I can tell you is, there's not many people from that city that go to the Super Bowl. And the Super Bowl is people that can get tickets, they can fly in, and then they got the tickets for people of their teams. And when you look at the two teams, Seattle, not a bastion of support over there. And then New England, I guess, kind of a left-wing city. But I tell you, a lot of Patriot fans are supporters of the president, especially this guy named Robert Kraft. I don't know how they got back there, but they are back there. Joining us now to discuss this and so much more is the best offensive lineman that ever played. Played for the Bengals for 13 years, got to the Super Bowl, didn't win it, but he's over that now. Here to break it down and talk about what he's going to be doing. He's going to be today. Anthony Munoz will be promoting the NFL-sanctioned Super Bowl breakfast. They're the Bart Starr Awards. You have been Man of the Year before, Anthony, and Bart Starr was just a fantastic human being.
Yeah, he was an amazing man. First of all, I need to find out what you take, Brian. You're like on air. I mean, you work all day. When do you sleep? And your face is on radio, well, on TV, you're doing radio. Very impressive. So great job on everything you do. Bart Starr, got to know Bart and Cherry. Bart was an amazing man, a man of character. Of course, you know, winning Super Bowls with the great Green Bay Packers teams. And, you know, it was quite an honor to be. Yeah, I received the Bart Starr Award way, way back. And, you know, to be a recipient, not only of the Walter Payton Man of the Year, but the Bart Starr Award, I mean, there's nothing like it. You know, that is not what you do on the football field. That's who you are as a person in the community with your family. And that impact goes so much further than what you do on the football field. So I'm excited about being part of the breakfast Saturday morning. Christian McCaffrey, not a bad football player, but a really great individual is receiving the Bart Starr Award. So we'll celebrate him Saturday morning. And this breakfast has been going on for years and years and years. And you look at the line of recipients. I mean, it's amazing. Mike Singletary, Steve Largent, you know, back to the day. And then a lot of the younger guys, Calais, you know, it's just Calais Campbell and, you know, guys like that. So it's pretty cool to be involved. I have a 45-year relationship with Athletes in Action. When the Bengals drafted me, it'll be 46 years now, drafted me. That was one of the first phone calls I made from Southern California as I was leaving Southern California, my wife, Didi, and I, to head to Cincinnati. And we called. They have staff members with just about every NFL team that does Bible studies, discipleship programs. They do chapel on Sunday morning since we're playing on Sunday. I've been on their board at one time and try to help out as much and really believe in the mission that they have, not only here domestically, but internationally with all their athletic teams around the world sharing the gospel. And to me, that's the great thing about it. You know, we do celebrate athletes, we do celebrate sports, but how you incorporate your faith in Christ with your athletics. And that's been my whole life. So I, you know, since college, so I'm thrilled to be part of that breakfast.
And that college was USC, right?
It was. And I have, you know, I live in Cincinnati, this part, that part of the country. So when I say that, I have to say the University of Southern California, the real USC, because they get confused. They think it's University of South Carolina.
But, right.
Yeah, I grew up in Ontario, California, about 40 miles east of L.A. Always wanted to go to USC. I knew financially, my mom raising five by herself, we couldn't do it. But I got a football scholarship, got my school paid for, and got the chance to play a little bit of football at USC.
Yeah, that worked out for them and for you, but it did work out for them. What would they, Anthony, can you imagine if you were coming out of high school, what would they say now, a five-star recruit? I don't know what they called it back then. So what do you think now, Anthony Munoz, 18-year-old, you'd be talking money now. You'd have an agent, right? Correct?
Yeah,
You'd have an agent. This is true.
Yeah.
And you would be listening to see basically who could pay you the most. This is a very interesting time.
It really is. I'm basically free agency in college.
Every year.
I mean, you get these student athletes or athletes that are moving from college to college based on how much money they're making. And, you know, I've always been an advocate of, you know, they should get compensated. But, man, they've taken it to a higher level because of the, you know, what you have to do and what it's called for. But you're right. You take the transfer portal, you take NIL, and it's just like you play. You know, guys will start at one college. And you think they're set there for the duration of the time, and all of a sudden they're off to another school because they've received more money. But that's the nature of the beast these days with college football. You know, again, you know, looking back a couple years ago when I was coming out, you're right. I probably had to educate myself, get an agent, and as an offensive lineman, probably get not even a quarter of what the quarterbacks and running backs are getting. But I'm sure we'd have gotten a little bit of money.
Well, I think people that, you know, they know football know you don't have anything if you don't have a line. So you would have got the money, maybe not the fame, but that's what just offensive linemen have to deal with. But to me, it's some easy fixes here. I mean, to me, there's got to be a place where you go in if you're an NIL, you want to be NIL eligible. Let's say I'm Nike and I want to be able to support some of my players. You got to fit the criteria. You have a pool of companies that are going to be part of it. There's only a certain amount they can give. I think that would be fine. And the other thing would be one transfer. Or if you transfer a second time, you got to sit out a year. The other thing, Anthony, what I worry about, and I hear Tom Brady talk about this, if I'm at Michigan and I'm fifth on the depth chart my freshman year, right? I might, maybe he would have been different, but I would go somewhere else. I can play, I get more money, I get recruited right off that roster. Yeah. But he said one of the greatest things to happen to him was to be forced to work his way up the depth chart and share the starting job, even his senior year, whether it was, I know he Drew Henson and with Brian Greasy.
Mm-hmm.
So those were formative experiences. Maybe it was not good to have $0. I understand that.
Right.
But I just think you got to quickly go in and format this because now the 18-year-olds have no shot of playing. They're recruiting 22-year-olds out of, let's say, mid-majors in order and changing their team, right?
I'm looking at these guys that are playing college and they're like 22 to 25. I was in the league already 3-4 years at that age. You know, and it's interesting because back in the day when I was at USC, you're right. We were 3-5 deep and you just competed. I mean, that's why I went to USC. I mean, I had confidence, but it was almost like, do I have enough confidence to believe I can? Well, if they want me, I'm going to go there and I'm going to compete. You know, I'm going up against a 2-time All-American on the defensive line. I got 3 or 4. Back then, they weren't 5 stars, but you know, you can consider them 5 stars back then. You just went in and competed and you stayed there. And that was the program. But, you know, and you talk about the fix, you know, it is becoming professional. So why not sign contracts? If you're going to pay $4 million to a quarterback, say you get that, but you got to commit to 2-3 years at least. And I think that's a good way to do that instead of go paying this kid one and then he's gone 1 year to the next, maybe sign him a 2-3 year contract if that's what they want.
Yeah, so Anthony, let's talk about this game and let's keep it with USC. Sam Darnold comes out of USC. The Jets draft him. He was on the Fox and Friends couch the next week. Couldn't be more impressed with the guy. Big, strong guy. Number 2 pick overall.
Yeah.
And the Jets had very little talent. And they did almost nothing with him there. And after a few years, they had another high draft pick and they let him go to Carolina. And from what I saw him play 4 times. He didn't look good. He goes to San Francisco as a backup. And when he was asked to step up, he looked good. You know, they have a way of, with a great coaching staff. Maybe, I think if you sit down with him, maybe he would tell you he learned a lot in the backup role there. Then goes to Minnesota, does great, but fails towards the end of the season. Not fails, but doesn't do as well towards the end of the season and the playoffs. And they go, okay, we're going to go with J.J. McCarthy. We're going to let him go. And then he ends up on this team and they're in the Super Bowl. That's such an interesting arc, isn't it?
It really is. It's a great story. Of course, being a Southern California guy, I'm a big Darnold fan. Watched him when he was at SC. Actually did a youth camp at the Jets facility his rookie year. And the whole rookie class was there. So Sam was there. Loved the young man. And what you just went through his history with, you know, the Jets and the Panthers. And it's so great to finally see someone step into an organization, into a system with Coach Mike McDonald. And here they are in the Super Bowl. And, you know, one other guy I can think about way back when I was playing is you look at Steve Young. Steve Young was with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And then he goes to the 49ers. He takes over after Montana leaves with George Seifert as the head coach. And wins a Super Bowl. He goes into a system that fits him. And I think a lot of times that's what happens. And, you know, it may
Anthony,
be because
is it coaches
system,
too? Is it coaches too?
I think it's a combination. It really is. I mean, you know, you look at another guy. I'm not going to say it just because he's a USC guy, but Caleb Williams at the Bears. I mean, horrendous rookie year. They get a new head coach and he lights it on fire this year. And,
he
you know, they're
great.
Close to. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a combination of coaches. In my own experience, you know, I go to Cincinnati and Kenny Anderson's there, who should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, he has Hall of Fame credentials and he got abused for, you know, the 2 years prior to Forrest Gregg being hired. And we come in and we get a new offensive coordinator, a new offensive line coach. And he goes from 2-4-12 seasons to 2 years after Forrest Gregg, he's the league MVP and we're going to the Super Bowl. So, yes, the coaches, the system, those players around you. And then I think it just gives the guy confidence in believing that he can play in that system.
And people got to be a little bit patient, too. Remember, Terry Bradshaw, they were ready to give up on him. They had three, Terry Hanratty and John Gilliam and others. They were ready to give up on him. Too many interceptions. And look what happened. And remember, Troy Aikman was, I think, won one game his rookie year.
Yes.
Now he's one of the best broadcasters and had a great 10-year career. Here's what he said about Darnold, cut 36.
I could not be more proud of anyone, quite honestly, for what Sam has endured, his perseverance, his resilience, and the way that he's continued to battle. I mean, a lesser person could have given up a while ago, and yet he has been unaffected. I mean, it's one thing to say, yeah, well, this is his living and this is what you do. But when you talk with him and he's interviewed and everything I've watched, in fact, I just saw an interview with him just before coming on the air with you today. I'm just amazed at how optimistic and upbeat he's been. He's not jaded by the process and he's been through a lot. And I bet that he would tell you that having gone through what he went through in New York and in Carolina, it really helped get him to where he is now.
I guess you agree with that.
I totally agree. Couldn't said it better. I mean, great words by Troy Aikman, and I truly believe in it. And, you know, a lot of times people don't like to hear, but I really believe those times, those trials and those obstacles get you ready for the battle. And it has gotten Sam Darnold ready for the battle. And he said he's proud to see what he's done. I mean, again, I am proud to see Sam Darnold fight and fight and fight. Right. And here he is. He's playing on the biggest stage, the Super Bowl.
And Anthony, we're talking to Anthony Munoz, by the way. But we're streaming it if you're watching on the app. A couple of things, Anthony. Let's say he has a bad first half. He's got the makeup. Well, of course. Okay, I had a bad first half. You don't think I'm coming back in the third quarter? I've come back for 5 years. I've come back when people thought I was done. On the other side, there's Drake May. 23 years old, they got another stud. This is a reflection on organizations. Seattle dipped to 500, a little bit below, and now they're back again. And then Kraft with four wins gets Vrabel, and they're smart enough the second time around. I guess Mac Jones they thought would be the guy. And now the second time around, they get Drake May at 23 years old, and he looks built for the part. So when you see when you saw the Patriots, people point to an easy schedule. I just saw a team that got better during the year and stepped up when they had to.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and again, I kind of chuckle when I hear easy schedules. I say, you know, you play an easy schedule. I want to see you play that team and see how you feel Monday morning after playing an easy team. But no, I think it's great. And again, we're talking about Mike McDonald, coaches with Seattle.
Yeah.
You know, you have to change the culture. The Patriots are down. They get Drake May, who is a great talent. But look at the head coach they got. I mean, a guy that played linebacker at Ohio State, played for the Patriots, and, you know, tough nose, had some success down in Tennessee. So I think they brought in the right guy. and Mike Vrabel to change the culture. And then they got, as every team needs, they need that quarterback in order to be successful. So things have turned quickly. And of course, yeah, I heard that stat where a lot of these teams have played, you know, top 10 easiest schedules in the Super Bowl. But you got to give the Patriots a lot of credit because they were down. And to be where they are so quickly, it's pretty impressive.
Lastly, Anthony, why don't more great players become coaches?
You know, that's a great question. You know, there's a lot of things that are being said. That's like, okay, just because you're a great player doesn't mean that you can sure. teach the game. I think there's just so many other options that are there for players that have been very successful. I can just speak for my personal experience. So if I did not have kids, if I didn't have a son and a daughter that were great athletes, and you talk about five-star, both are five-star, went on to college. If I didn't have two kids, I've been retired 33 years. I would be in my 33rd year of coaching. I love teaching that yeah. much, and I have confidence. I know that I can pass what I was taught on, and I did. I coached high school for 3 years. I coached five NFL camps. They let me come in and coach, but I didn't want to miss my kids grow up. My son was a four-year starter at the University of Tennessee. I watched every one of his games home and away. My daughter played basketball 1 year at Tennessee, three at Ohio State. I didn't want to miss that. So and I think a lot of times you have, I mean, you know, get a guy like Tom Brady, great football player, but look at the job he's doing in broadcast. You mentioned Troy Aikman. There's a lot of other opportunities
yeah.
that guys have. And they choose to do that instead of, because I know the time that you have to spend as a coach. I did that in camp, and that wasn't the problem with me. Like I said, it was watching my kids grow up.
Yeah.
I don't know why guys that had great careers, some of them do, you know, Charlie Joyner, Hall of Fame wide receiver, Fred Biletnikoff, yeah. Hall of Fame. They coached for a lot of years. Art Shell, head coach. Offensive line coach, Hall of Fame tackle, guy that I admired growing up through, you know, in Southern California, USC when he was with the Raiders. So there are guys that have done. Forrest Gregg, my first head coach, was a Hall of Fame offensive lineman.
And Bart Starr. Bart Starr, didn't have a great record,
yeah.
but man, that's really, right. to be full circle, that's yeah. the breakfast you're going to be hosting on yep. The Bart Starr Awards, given out to great men who play the game, who are leaders in their families, with their teammates and their community. And this year's winner is Christian McCaffrey. Anthony, always look forward to this almost as much as the Super Bowl, our conversations. Man. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Hey, Brian, thank you very much. One favor. Can you say hi to my second favorite Fox guy, Bill Hemmer?
Absolutely.
He's my second favorite.
As long as he stays number two, you got it. He's got that Cincinnati connection.
I hope he doesn't hear this. Don't say that because I don't want him smacking me in the head next time I see him at home.
I know. He can be intimidating to you, Anthony. I know.
He can. Hey, Brian, always great being with you, man. Keep up the great work.
All right. Go get him, Anthony. Back in a moment.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. And by the way, just got some good news about our YouTube. We're off to a great start. We got our own YouTube channel. So check it out, youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadeShow, which is highlights from this show, every show. But we also have other clips out there. So, for example, I'm hosting Will Kane 4 o'clock on Friday. You'll probably see some of those clips over the weekend or on Monday. Fox and Friends every day. There's always things going on. I'm trying to do original stuff, too. And you got the Sunday show. So you'll see clips on there. So you don't have to skate around and say, I'm going to go to Instagram. I'm going to go here. Just go to YouTube. So hopefully you'll continue to join the channel and be a part of it. Also, I hope to see everybody in Fort Myers, Florida on the 14th on Saturday night. BrianKilmeade.com. Balcony seats are still available, which I hear are great, great seats. Now we have Evansville, Indiana, which goes on live soon. And, of course, we have Reno, Nevada, May 30th. So that's going to be fun, too. A little bit of a further ride, but it's going to be great to get out of this cold weather. And I think by May, it'll warm up, I hope.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian.
All right, here we go from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where there's a sign that shows Gavin Newsom in a Jet jersey saying his record is worse than the Jets. I'm sure they're not happy. The California Business Association put it up, but it's important. Don't just get caught up in him looking the part with his biography and your heartstrings being pulled. He's a terrible governor, and that's the point. Senator Steve Daines is going to be with us in 30 minutes, standing by. He's out of Ohio. Senator John Husted, he's going to be here. And, of course, we're monitoring the prayer breakfast that the president's hosting, because he always tends to make news as he gets off prompter and has a good time with people he's very comfortable with. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We see people taking advantage of loopholes in the law and operating these illegal labs with these pathogens, as we've discussed, from malaria to HIV. And that really is a threat to the security of the United States.
Killer Chinese biolabs uncovered in Las Vegas and Los Angeles. And Red China's financing it? Why is this not a bigger story? The question, why did the last FBI director said, no big deal? The guy is an illegal immigrant from China in jail and running these lethal labs. I got to get to the bottom of this.
Number two.
These are the types of numbers that should really worry Republicans. Okay, Republicans margins in Texas. Trump won it by 14 points. But look at the generic ballot, the generic House ballot. Now we're talking about a Republican advantage of just 1-2 points.
Howard Harry Enten of CNN pointing out the polls. Politics aplenty. A major announcement from Kamala today turns out to be somewhat of a dud. She's going to have a website. Kamala HQ, as the GOP realizes they're getting in a lot of trouble and a wake-up call from the Hispanic community right before the midterms, although the money is flowing into their coffers.
Number one.
Mr. President, speaking of Minneapolis, what did you learn?
I learned that maybe we can use a little bit of a softer touch, but you still have to be tough.
Putting back. Though putting it all together the right way in Minneapolis, as the president admits he needed a course correction in his illegal immigrant sweep, but he's not going to stop. He's going to do it differently. With us right now is John Husted. Senator, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Senator, your thoughts about the president saying, hey, we could use a softer touch like what happened in Minneapolis. We know about the two deaths from the activists, but he said, of course, nobody's happy about that situation. ICE is not happy. Obviously, the families are not happy. The protesters aren't happy. But it was out of control, and I think there's a lot of irresponsibility for local officials. But do you welcome the lighter touch?
Well, I think it's the recognition that people want ICE to focus on the mission of getting the criminals first out of places like Minneapolis, out of our country, who are committing violent crimes, who are causing dealing drugs, doing things like that. But they don't want to see the confrontations.
Yeah.
They certainly don't want to see shootings. They don't want to see those kinds of things. And so it's really just getting refocused. And that's what Tom Homan is doing. And the key issue, I'm just going to focus on this. When you have sanctuary cities, those become places where the worst of the worst want to go hide because they know they're shielded there. If we can just get local police, local communities to cooperate with ICE, that when they pick up somebody for a DUI, for drug dealing, that the local authorities will turn them over to ICE for ICE to then go through the process of deportation rather than releasing them back out in the community where ICE then has to go try to find them. That's the fundamental issue that if we can get that resolved, I believe this will go much more smoothly for everyone.
Yeah, basically the president brought up yesterday, I'm not going to play the cut, but it's basically with NBC. Why don't you talk about all the criminals we got out of there? They scooped up over 4,000 out of Minneapolis, and now Minnesota says we don't have a crime problem. We're decreasing more than ever before, as if we can't put two and two together and connect the dots. It has everything to do with the amount of illegal immigrants pulled out. Look at your second city, Washington, D.C. Senator, what's it like now? I mean, they had no murders for the first time in a month in years, and crime was really tackled directly by the president.
Yeah, absolutely. When you know that there's a consequence for committing a crime, there's a lot less likely that people will commit crime. Imagine that. There needs to be consequences, accountability. There needs to be a presence. There needs to be an effort. And when you see that happen, crime goes down. Murders are the lowest rate that they've been in many, many decades in this country. It's because we've put an emphasis on this. And you can't let you know, millions of people who are unvetted come into this country, who deal drugs, commit sex crimes, homicides, other things, let that go unchecked. Now that we're sealing off the border and doing those kinds of things, you're seeing violent crimes go down. But the president and Tom Homan under his direction, I think doing a reset on this is going to be good for everyone.
I want to talk about your Upward Mobility Act and talk about affordability and how you're tackling it. But I want you, everyone at home who have jobs during the day and missed the show yesterday, to hear some of the exchanges and the way our Treasury Secretary was talked to. Instead of getting questions from him about the strategy and the economy and what you're thinking, even if you're a critic, this is what we heard. Listen to this. Cut 29.
I would know, Congressman. I take that as a no. You traveled to Venezuela.
I take that as a no.
I haven't asked you any more questions.
It's the gentleman from Massachusetts.
I'm trying to get to my next question.
Could you speak a little louder? I can't hear you. 10 and 20 million immigrants.
Can you shut the house?
I mean, can you believe? I mean, this exchange. This is a guy that ran a $1 billion hedge fund that graduated from Yale. He's not a WWE brawler. Senator, I can't believe they don't let him finish. For example, Gregory Meeks, he went out and met with Hugo Chavez. This guy wanted to do deals with him. You know, this guy, French Hill, Stephen Lynch, wants to jump down his throat. Your thought?
Well, that's all a performance where they want to try to look tough. And being rude is somehow confused with being tough, I guess, on the Democratic Party side. But it's not the, you know, the Treasury Secretary is a very, very bright man.
He's
got a lot of knowledge about the economy, about how deals can be done across the globe. And they ought to ask him some questions and listened and learned from him, because there's a lot to be learned by listening to the Treasury Secretary. And treating people disrespectfully is something, look, that's how I think I always try to separate myself. It's like I can disagree with people, but I don't have to call them names, and I don't have to try to shout at them. Let's have an honest exchange.
I'll give an example. For example, he has said in the past, because Scott was on here, Bessent, on my radio show a lot before he was Treasury Secretary. He has said in the past he wasn't the biggest fan of net tariffs, as is Larry Kudlow. Larry Kudlow is one of the president's best friends. But now that he sees some of this in action, he's changed his mind on a lot of it. That would have been a good exchange.
It would have been a very good exchange.
That's interesting to the audience. That helps people.
Well, yeah, explain. It's like, okay, you once had this position, now you have this position.
Yeah.
What made you change your mind about it? I think that what he would say is that you need a tool to have leverage against China in these negotiations. These tariffs are a tool for negotiation to try to get a fair deal for the American people, for American business, for the American consumer.
Yeah, and by the way, no one's talking about the India deal. That is huge. That's what it's for. You bring in tariffs, you get their attention, and then you talk about what's going to work and open up your markets, or whatever South Korea you need. What do you need one in Japan? Everyone's got different times in which the president feels that you're not buying enough American goods, or we want to incentivize you to bring things back home. And then we'll see. The European deal, I hope, gets back on track. So it all seems to be a way to get the economy going, as in what you're doing. Tell me about the Upward Mobility Act.
Yeah, it's a passion project of mine, because many people who are in poverty are trapped. Why are they trapped? Because they fall off something called the benefits cliff. If you're a single parent, you have two kids, you're working 20 hours a week, making $17 an hour, maybe you get housing assistance or SNAP assistance, something along those lines, and then you get a raise to $18 an hour, then you might lose $5,000 worth of benefits. And so what's a person, rational person, do? They don't work more, because we don't pay them. It doesn't pay to work more. So we trap people in poverty. And what I'm trying to do is to help give governors at the state level the ability to gradually reduce benefits as people earn more, so that we restore the incentive to work, get people out of this poverty trap into self-sufficiency and a pathway to the middle class. For 50 years in this country, in the name of compassion, we've trapped people in poverty. I want to end that. I want to help more of them find a pathway into the middle class.
And what happens is, you mean trapped. So you try, hey, okay, they lost their job, they're going to need some help. So you help them,
yeah.
But then you put the threshold so high, it doesn't pay to go get that job and get back in the workforce. So you want to do something on a sliding scale, right? And this is a five-year pilot program?
A pilot program for five states is how we want to do it. I want to give you a really good example, though, of how we trap particularly young people. I was at a career center where they teach welding, auto mechanic, you know, auto body, all those kinds of things. The principal said to me, he said, hey, I've got a lot of young people who are in poverty. They want to get apprenticeships. They want to go be welders. But if they go to work as an apprentice while they're in high school, then their younger brother and sister loses all their food benefits. Mom might lose her housing benefit. And so they don't go to work. They don't learn a skill because it punishes their family. Like,
and just to, those just, and why, things, Senator, I'm just going to take a step back, because then you're bringing in more income that brings you over the threshold.
Yeah, your income counts against your family income. And so therefore they lose more in benefits than they gain in revenue for their family. And so kids don't go to work. And we wonder why we create these generational cycles of poverty in this country. It's because it's poverty by design. We put these programs in place. People who need help temporarily get trapped because as they try to earn more, they actually have less in take home benefits. And so I'm trying to end all that.
All right. So they say that Blake Moore will introduce the companion bill to the Upward Mobility Act in the House, too.
Yes, Blake Moore is going to do it, a House member from Utah. I already have a governor from Ohio, Mike DeWine's commitment that they will that he will do this in Ohio. We want to try to get this passed on a bipartisan basis. And this is the single most important thing we can do for America's lowest income earners to make life more affordable to them, because they will actually be allowed to work, earn more, have more take-home pay as they gradually reduce their dependence on public assistance.
Quick thing on the student. So you're a high school student. You want to become an apprentice. You want to be a welder. You know, obviously, you're in the exempt status when you're a student. So what would you do? Not count that salary against the family?
No, you would give that zero? Child okay. The ability to earn. And you would design this at the state level, so people could do it differently. But I mean, what I would propose is that we don't use those tests against the kids. We want the kids to get the job skills so that they can go to work, because they're about ready to turn 18. They're about ready to be out into the world all on their own. And we don't give them the ability to earn and begin to build a future for themselves. So I once heard somebody say, Brian, this is great. I had a company, the CEO said, you know, China subsidizes a lot of their people to go to work and they compete against our companies. I said, well, they get it better than America because we subsidize people not to work in our nation. We want to give them an incentive to go to work and have more take-home pay.
And Senator, right now you're looking at the midterm. You're going to have a tough election with Sherrod Brown, who's been there forever. What are your thoughts?
Well, look, you know, I'm in my Senate office, so I'm not going to get too much into politics, but I've been blessed by the voters of Ohio. Look, I'm just a kid. I started out life in foster care. I got adopted. I grew up in a small rural town. You know, my dad lost his job at a factory when I was just graduating high school. I've seen the worst, the tough times in places like Ohio, who struggled, and now we're a nation on the way back. We're a state on the way back. We're doing more made in America. We're getting more investments in building factories in our country, making the things that are essential to our economic and national security. It's happening in places like Ohio. I'm trying to help working families. Look, the working family tax cut plan is the biggest boost that we've given to working class folks in this country in quite a while. No tax on tips, no tax on overtime, cutting taxes on Social Security, a $2,200 per child tax credit for a family of four. You know, that's a big boost to them. And so I'm focused on working families. And I think if you just take care of your constituents, you build a strong economy, that you get rewarded at the ballot box.
And we'll see. It's got to be a tough battle, but I know the Republicans have a lot of faith that you're going to hold on to that seat and do what Bernie Moreno did and beat Sherrod Brown, who at one point was thought as a presidential contender. Senator, thanks so much. I'm glad you're doing this, all this positive stuff. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you
you listen, the more you'll know.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Obviously, people look at that and say, is the CCP operating other bio labs in our country?
And look at what this FBI has done. We arrested three researchers at the University of Michigan with ties to the CCP for bringing in biologicals and for trying to harm our agricultural seed industry. That is the priority here to protecting our nation's not just secrets, but our agriculture and our citizens' health.
So get this. They found Chinese bio labs, I mean, with lethal diseases like the Ebola virus and COVID-19. They found him in Los Angeles. They arrested the guy. It turns out he's an illegal immigrant from China. He goes to jail, and then they find out that he's made hundreds of calls to another lab in Las Vegas. Well, what is that lab? Another Chinese bio lab, evil bio lab, which basically exists to house and refrigerate viruses. Why would you be doing that with financing coming from, drumroll please, the Chinese government? So they found this 62-year-old was arrested back in 2023. They found his L.A. lab, and now he's running his Las Vegas lab from jail. How is he allowed to have hundreds of calls from jail, by the way? Another underground biolab was raided this week in Vegas. They discovered 1,000 suspected samples of biological agents linked to a Chinese national. As you know, the guy has a bunch of aliases. You don't know him. Zhai Bing Zhu is one of the names he uses. The Chinese national had multiple aliases, had been in California jail for 2 years. He awaits a federal trial for selling bogus COVID-19 and bogus pregnancy test kits. You think that's bad? Okay, what's the big deal? Put him in jail, right? Shouldn't do it. But when they found a beat up warehouse that contained tuberculosis, HIV, malaria, and other infectious agents, I think that's a pretty big story. When asked about it, the previous FBI director said there's no link to China. No big deal. Just a one-off. It isn't a one-off. Why are you minimizing this? You should be maximizing this. You should be accused of getting people too upset who are already worried about another pandemic that the Chinese started. They contain nearly 1,000 transgenetic mice designed to carry COVID-19. Freezer labeled Ebola they found in Las Vegas. Really? Does it get worse than this? More dangerous than this? Maybe if they had a nuclear weapon, I might be marginally more worried. But why are we letting China get away with this? They should be forced to confront this. Listen, we have financing that goes right back to your country. What are you doing? Are you looking to wipe out an entire city? Hold a city hostage by sending over your lunatics who happen to have a degree in biology to do what you did last time? Poison the world? I don't even know that we got all of them, do you? Jeez. I had to get that out of my system. I'll talk about it more. I want to get your calls on that when we come back. Possibly a surprise guest or Senator Steve Daines, who's still in the prayer breakfast with the president. Obviously, you can't just get up and walk out. So maybe I'll join us sometime this half hour.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think we feel really good about, you know, where our Senate races are. The Dems are targeting a number of our incumbents, and so we've got some races that are going to be expensive and hard fought in places like Maine and North Carolina. The Democrats are bullish on other states like, Ohio and Alaska, but we also have some really good opportunities, we think, in states for potential pickups.
Senator Dan Sullivan's got a tough fight, but he is a fantastic senator, so qualified, served in the military, worked for the Bush administration, now up in Alaska, who really understands Alaska. He was at sounding the alarm about how the Russian presence, they got 50 icebreakers. We only own two, and they're in the Arctic just smashing ice, trying to take it over, and right by our border, right by the edge of the land over in Alaska, as is China. I think it would be a huge mistake. If people of Alaska think they're going to be better served by somebody else, I just don't. I think that's crazy. But Ohio's going to be tough. You just heard that. And they seem to be going after Susan Collins, but they always are going after Susan Collins over in Maine. So there's a lot of themes going on right now, one of which is affordability. If the economy starts catching fire, like it seems to be on the macro level, if it starts happening on a micro level and you could start seeing an unfreezing of the housing market, I think that would be really important.
Here's what Harry Enten said on CNN, big pollster over there. Cut 20.
If you remember back in 2024, right, it was all about, we were talking about the blue wall. If Kamala Harris could win the baseline Democratic states and then add in the blue wall states of Michigan, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, she would get to 270 electoral votes. But if all of a sudden we in fact have applying the 2025 estimates, the population estimates, to the Electoral College, the blue states, plus the blue wall of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin would no longer be enough. Under the current estimates, you get to exactly 270 electoral votes, the minimum needed to win the Electoral College. If, in fact, you apply the 2025 estimates, look at that. You would only get to 263 electoral votes if you were a Democrat, which would mean a Republican victory.
And one of the big things is the migration. And when they do a census, they're going to find out that Texas is going to be adding seats. They're going to be losing seats in New York and in California because people are leaving that area. So I know everyone's worried about 2028, but if you wait for 2030, things are really going to be going the Republicans' directions, theoretically. Cut 22.
Republicans have been hoping to squeeze out more Republican seats from that state with the redistricting efforts, right? These are the types of numbers that should really worry Republicans. Okay, Republicans' margins in Texas. Trump won it by 14 points. But look at the generic ballot, the generic House ballot. Now we're talking about a Republican advantage of just 1-2 points. That was a big influence in terms of what happened in Texas 9.
Yeah,
they got a good candidate, but it was also the environment has shifted so much to the left, right? This looks a whole heck of a lot like what we saw in 2018 when Republicans barely won that House vote. You put this together with this, together with this, and all of a sudden you can see how Democrats can really get wring out a lot of seats from the big states, the blue ones in California, New York, and of course the red one historically in the state of Texas.
So look, I think things are so much better now in so many ways, from the DEI being down in the dumps to woke being pushed back, between the military going, the competency of our foreign policy. We're seeing hopefully an end. Hopefully the Ukraine-Russia war, we had trilateral conversations. You saw what happened in Venezuela. You see what's going to happen. The Houthi rebels have been suppressed, and you see the taking out of the Iranian nuclear program and possibly out of that government shortly. But yet, if you look at the polls, they worry about the economy first. And when asked on the Fox News poll, is the country better off or worse today than a year ago? 54% say it is worse. Only 31% say it's better. 16% say it's the same. So that's the Hispanic vote, a lot of people believe. And Tony Gonzalez, a conservative Republican who's in Texas and serves at the Borders District, he said this should be an eye-opener after that state won race by a Democrat, that Donald Trump won the district by 18 points. He says candidates have to do their part. The party has to do their part. And those of us in the arena, we have to do our part. Ted Cruz says this, that election on Tuesday is very concerning. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick posted on X that the result should be a wake-up call for Republicans. Is it? It should be. I would hope it's going to be. I would think it is going to be. But they have plenty of time to correct things. I don't think there's any doubt about it. They're depending a lot on Tim Scott. You know, he's in charge of keeping the Senate, and the Republican Party continuing to raise money. But as Senator Tim Scott knows, the one problem is Trump's not on the ballot. Of course, term limited out. Having a convention is a good idea. Cut 17.
Donald Trump is not on the ballot in 2026. And we've seen in the past that MAGA supporters maybe don't always go to the polls when the president isn't on the ballot. Are you concerned about that? And how much do you want to see him out on the campaign trail with your Senate candidates and incumbents?
Well, Donald Trump is on the ballot. And that's why he's been so active around the country, making sure that he keeps his message crystal clear. He is 100% behind our candidates. I look forward to seeing the president on the campaign trail across this country. We know one thing, this new working class coalition, they love the results that President Trump has produced, but it's taken a Senate majority and a House majority to support the president's agenda. That's why one team, one party, our success.
Yeah, and we'll see. I think he's got such a great personality, and he's so upbeat, and Tim Scott can raise money with anyone. He's very hooked in with those in the financial community. So I want to, before we go, and I'm going to talk more about this with, I'm going to talk, the other big story is Iran. Didn't make the big three, but it should. I think at any moment we're going to start bombing the hell out of them, and what we're going to be targeting is going to be interesting. The IRGC, do we leave them alone and just take out the the autocratic regime led by the 86-year-old Ayatollah. Remember, we go after Nasrallah. They said, if you kill Nasrallah, who's leading Hezbollah over in Lebanon, the whole region's going to go in flames. He's been dead now for 2 years. It never went in flames. Nothing even close to in flames. So I'll talk more about that. I'll talk more about that with Lucas Tomlinson, who's going to be joining us shortly. And he is, of course, he's got the military background, reports on the Pentagon, but now he also is traveling with the president. The big story in the LA Times, and I got to give them credit, they have found a story that in October of this past year, of 2025, they did a report on what went wrong leading to the LA fires. Did they make everything worse? Was it possible to save some of those homes? The answer is absolutely. They know about the problems with the engines now, fire engines not working. They know about the problems with the water not being there. They know about the problems with Karen Bass being in Ghana. So the report comes out in October, and two sources close to the mayor verify this story that she told them to soften up the report, and she held on to it until they changed it. They don't know that she had line-by-line edits, but she changed the report. She says after repeated denials, she's now directly linked to changes made to the Los Angeles Fire Department's after action report. This was told to the LA newspaper, the LA Times. Now, not only did these two Karen Bass confidants come forward to the LA Times, they said they're willing to go under oath to back up their story, put their hand on the Bible. It's unclear whether Villanueva, who is now running the LAFD, or anyone else in the mayor's office made the line-by-line edits that Bass instructed them to do. One Bass confidant says the mayor didn't tell the truth when she said she had nothing to do with the changing report. The confidant told the report was a bad idea. It would hurt her politically to change the report. That's what the confidant said. The confidant also said they held on to the original draft until the changes were made, and then it was released. All right, when we come back, Lucas Tomlinson's going to be with us. We're going to be talking about what's happening with the trilateral talks over in the U.S. is the go-between between Ukraine and Russia, and also the latest on the Friday talks, one-on-one, with the foreign minister of Iran and us. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Should the supreme leader in Iran be worried right now?
I would say he should be very worried, yeah. He should be. As you know, they're negotiating with us. If we didn't take out that nuclear, we wouldn't have peace in the Middle East because the Arab countries could have never done that. They were very, very afraid of Iran.
Yeah.
They're not afraid of Iran anymore.
That is so true. And by the way, if they got nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia's prince flat out said, we're getting it. If they get it, we're getting it. So the whole, can you imagine the Middle East with nuclear weapons? Well, that really could have happened. Lucas Tomlinson joins us now, Pentagon reporter, does everything all over Washington, follows the president around, military background. Lucas, welcome back.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Hey, Lucas, I'm seeing our buildup of the president calls it an armada, but it's more than that. It's defensive capacity with the THAAD missile system, the Patriots being bulked up. I'm seeing Israeli generals meeting with ours in the region. Where do you think we're heading as talks are scheduled for Friday with Iran, its foreign minister?
Well, these are big talks that are happening tomorrow in Oman, Brian, and Steve Witkoff, who, by the way, is in Abu Dhabi right now meeting with the Russians. You think there's a lot on his plate right now trying to end a war and prevent one? Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are going to go to Oman tomorrow to meet with the Iranians. If these talks go south, it is highly likely we are heading to armed conflict with Iran because the Iranians are going to be shifty, I'm sure, with these talks, and they're going to try to string the Trump administration along. But as we saw with Midnight Hammer over the summer, there's only so much the Trump administration wants to engage with the Iranians. By the way, quick story, when President Trump said the Arabs couldn't have done this. During the World Cup, when it was held in Qatar, the Qataris were flying F-15s orbiting over the stadiums unarmed because they were not qualified to fire the weapons. That just tells you a little bit about what the president was talking about there, Brian. A little tidbit.
Right, but why do you think the Middle East seems to be speaking out pretty much unanimously that they don't want to see us take action?
They're worried that they could be caught in the crossfire. Remember, after the 12-day war, the conclusion, and after the bombing of the nuclear facilities, the Iranians did retaliate. They fired about a dozen ballistic missiles at Al Udeid, the largest American base in the region, in Qatar. It's the home of the U.S. Central Command's Air Force, essentially, where they control the air, the skies in the Middle East. Those missiles had to be shot down using Qatari and U.S. Patriot interceptors. They don't want to be caught in the crossfire. There's also some talk, Brian, do some of these Arab countries want to see a thriving democracy across the Persian Gulf in Iran? They certainly don't have no love lost for the supreme leader, of course, but there's concern about their proxy forces. You know, we've seen these Shia revivals in the past. You've got a lot of U.S. interest in the region, not just the bases, but embassies, American business, and what the Arabs want to see, the Gulf allies, is peace, not a full-fledged regional conflict.
Are they worried about it spreading? Are they worried about it spreading too, like the Arab Spring?
They are worried about it spreading, and also, you know, when the Ayatollah warned about a regional war, he wasn't just sending that back to the White House. He was sending that to allies in the region. But I think that's a good point you're making, is, you know, when you look around the Middle East, it's not a home of thriving democracies. Now, when President Trump did his tour of the Middle East, his first overseas trip was to the region, to Riyadh, to Abu Dhabi, and to Doha and Qatar, he said, you know, for too long, America has been lecturing the Middle East on what, you know, you want to do. He wanted commerce, not conflict. And the president, if he had his way, it would be commerce, you know, especially with Iran, their oil, their people. You know, the people on the ground in Iran, the protesters, love the United States. It's the government that hates us.
Right. So, but the president kind of backed himself into a corner, maybe intentionally, when he said to the Iranian protesters, I hear you. I got you back. Go riot. Yeah. And he basically, they got mowed down, if not run over by cars, right, by just shot and executed.
Mm-hmm. And the president said, help is on the way. They heard that. To your point, more people took to the streets, thought the help was on the way. They haven't seen that. But as we've heard from General Keane and many Republicans on Capitol Hill, you know, when America makes a promise, people want to see that followed through. That's why there's so much hanging on these talks in Oman tomorrow. But it's notable, Brian, the Iranians just want to talk about nuclear weapons, nuclear warheads. The Trump administration, the American delegation, wants to expand. He wants to talk about ballistic missiles, wants to talk about Iran support the proxy forces, who no doubt have been greatly diminished in recent years thanks to the U.S. and Israel, mostly the Israelis, of course, in Gaza and in Lebanon and in Yemen against the Houthis. But the Iranians just want to focus on nuclear weapons. And the concern is, will they try to string the administration along?
I think last time, you know, the president just cut it off after, what, four or five rounds,
sure,
and Witkoff,
no,
too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think you should have someone dedicated to that area. You don't need Witkoff doing the Gaza situation, Russia, Ukraine. I mean, even Kissinger wouldn't do that. I mean, I just don't understand. You just give one guy this option. But we'll see what goes on. So we'll see what happens there. Now, in a situation, the president's made it clear he doesn't want to do regime change. He wants to take out problematic leaders. And so to do that, do you think what changes if the Ayatollah and the clerics around him are dead or ousted and the IRGC is in control? Does anything change?
Not much, but if the Ayatollah were to be assassinated, taken out, the concern is just Shia fundamentalism. We saw in the Iran-Iraq War in the 80s, if you don't mind me going back that far, you know, 37,000 Iranian children were killed, martyred. They were sending them out in the minefields, jumping on Iraqi tanks. The concern is, will this unite the Shia crescent throughout the Middle East against the U.S. and its interests? That's why there's concern. Because, you know, the Israelis could have taken out the Ayatollah as well. They didn't do it for a reason during the war. If the IRGC were to take over, the Bajij, their ground troops, their paramilitary forces on the streets, is that a better outcome? Probably not. Certainly not for the protesters, which is what makes all this very delicate. Anybody who says they have a simple answer to this, I think is nuts.
Right. And Marco Rubio said this might be an opportunity, but just talking about the nuclear situation won't be it. It's got to be not financing the proxies, mm-hmm, number one. Number two is, How do you support the people of Iran? You can't say, you have my word, shake my hand, I will not execute them in cold blood anymore. There's footage, and you've seen it online, of this woman going to her house being chased by these guys. As she goes to turn the doorknob, she just gets shot in cold blood. Then we're watching an SUV just go down the street and just mowing down people. So the Ayatollah says, whatever it takes, the words were, whatever it takes, I need to stay in power.
Right, and that's where maybe let's talk about some deniable operations. You know, CIA can get more involved. Mossad, do you arm the partisans? Do you arm the resistance like we did with the French in World War II? Are there things you can do that are deniable? There was a mysterious explosion in Bandar Abbas this past weekend. Nobody knows the outcome. Ostensibly, it was a gas leak. But you wonder, are there things that can people do from the Trump administration, from the U.S. side, that are not as overt, but to help those protesters in the streets?
So they shut down the internet, and I didn't know this, but they cost money. It cost them multi-million dollars a day just to keep the internet shut off. So in a country that can't pay their bills, that's significant.
And that's why those protesters are taking to the streets. They don't just want to see regime changes, their dire economic conditions. A friend of mine whose cousin is inside Iran, she shared with me some texts from her over this past weekend, and they're protesting for the basic necessities of life. When it takes, you know, 1.4 rial for every American dollar, and you need a wheelbarrow to go shopping, that's not a good economic situation. It's just basic needs that are not being met by the Iranian government, and people are yearning for change. They know the Iranian revolution has been an abject failure almost 50 years now. And they want to see change. It's a very pro-Western mindset. Remember, before the Iranian Revolution, this was a secular country, a pluralistic nation. You had 80,000 Jews that lived in Iran, for crying out loud. They've been there for 3,000 years.
Lucas Tomlinson, always insightful. Thanks so much.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Moving ahead with the 11 o'clock hour. Standing by is Jonathan Turley, constitutional law professor, Fox News contributor, author of Rage and the Republic. Rod Woodson's going to be here, too. Pro Football Hall of Famer, maybe the best defensive back. One of the best defensive backs in NFL history. Certainly fantastic. Steeler, how does he feel about the coaching change? He's going to be joining us from San Francisco, side of Super Bowl 60. The President of the United States just wrapped up his prayer breakfast speech. He was all over the place in a fun, insightful way. And now we're waiting in about 2 hours. We're going to find out about the latest with Savannah Guthrie's mom over. We're going to be updated from the sheriff and I hope lead investigators. The sheriff seems like a nice guy, but somewhat out of his league. So before we get to Jonathan, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We see people taking advantage of loopholes in the law and operating these illegal labs with these pathogens, as we've discussed, from malaria to HIV, and that really is a threat to the security of the United States.
There's no doubt about it. Killer Chinese biolabs uncovered, Las Vegas and Los Angeles, direct links to China. Why are we soft-pedaling this? This is a huge story. The Ebola virus, COVID-19, tuberculosis, being kept in a dilapidated warehouse, and the guy that did it is in jail? Already an illegal immigrant from China.
Number two.
These are the types of numbers that should really worry Republicans. Okay, Republicans' margins in Texas. Trump won it by 14 points. But look at the generic ballot, the generic House ballot. Now we're talking about a Republican advantage of just 1-2 points.
Politics aplenty. A major announcement from Kamala. Not so major. She's going to have her own website. As the GOP realizes they're getting a Hispanic wake-up call, before the midterm elections, will they hit snooze or realize they got to change their ways in some ways?
Number one.
Mr. President, speaking of Minneapolis, what did you learn?
I learned that maybe we can use a little bit of a softer touch, but you still have to be tough.
Putting back the right way, Minneapolis, as the president admits, he needed a course correction on illegal immigration, but the sweep continues, but we'll discuss. Jonathan Turley joins us now. So, Jonathan, the president never says he's wrong, but he does says he needs somewhat of a course correction after the death of two beyond protesters. activists, I would say. Your reaction to what's taken place over the last few days?
Well, you know, it's very funny to hear Tom Homan constantly thank the unprecedented cooperation by the governor, attorney general, and mayor. It's like getting the kiss from Marlon Brando. These are people whose base wants no cooperation at all. And so it's a very clever way of reminding people that the operation is going to go forward. It's just that the conditions have changed. I think that this spiraled out of control. It wasn't, I think, entirely the fault of the administration. You know, you have people who were trying to trigger these confrontations, and they will continue to do so. But ultimately, you know, the polling on immigration enforcement remains very high. It's just that the methods here have got to be changed. I mean, these people that wanted a confrontation succeeded in getting those optics.
So, Jonathan, tell me if this what's legal. So we see this organization form. These are the anti-ICE organizations. We see that they communicate. We see them running plates. We see them through the Signal app communicating, setting up an army. In fact, the people are getting paid. Then we watch over the weekend, they're setting up checkpoints in these cities. Out of everything I mentioned, what's allowed, what's this organization, and what's illegal?
Well, citizens are allowed to take photographs in public, including using public information like license plates. They are not allowed to create checkpoints, and they're not allowed to stop other citizens. They don't have authority for that. So presumably those checkpoints will be taken down. That's what Tom Holman said was promised to him by the sheriff.
That's got to happen. So you write this book, reveals the unfinished story of the American Revolution. It's called Rage and the Republic. When did you realize going back to 1776 would be beneficial to understanding what we're doing now?
Well, you know, it is a fascinating journey because the first half of the book looks at the conditions and personalities and events that led to this unique republic. And I look specifically at the American and French revolutions that occurred around the same time and asks the question why, one, the American Revolution became the oldest and most successful democracy in history, and the other went on to become the so-called Reign of Terror, with tens of thousands of people being guillotined. So the book identifies those critical factors and then asks for the second half, can that republic survive in the 21st century? We're facing unprecedented challenges from robotics to AI to global governance systems to what I call the rise of the new Jacobins. Now, those were the people that brought us the French Revolution. But we're hearing many of those same voices today, people who want more direct democracy. They want to take down a lot of the Madisonian precautions that were the reason why the American Revolution succeeded. It's the reason we're here today.
Give me an example of taking down of some of what Madison's role in the writing of the Constitution.
Well, we've seen this before. You know, the book looks through the eyes, or certainly follows the journey of Thomas Paine, one of the most fascinating historical figures I've ever written about. And Paine has a distinction of being one of two figures that played a role in both the American and French Revolution, the other being Lafayette. Paine was not a great advocate of these precautions by Madison. And when he went to France, he supported their effort to have greater democratic will to reduce these barriers and limitations. It damn near killed him. He came within 24 hours of being executed, and he realized that the real miracle of Philadelphia was that they found the sort of secret sauce, the way to have democracy in a republic without it destroying itself. Because the framers were afraid of creating a mobocracy, because history has shown democracies can devour themselves. So when you listen to these voices today, a lot of them are trying to take down those very precautions. You've got law professors, deans saying that the U.S. Constitution's a failure. Many want to take down or pack the Supreme Court, change the U.S. Senate, get rid of the Electoral College. All of these things are ways to control impulse, to keep us from destroying ourselves.
But they say the filibuster was not in the Constitution, the 60-vote margin. You want to clarify that?
Well, the fact is that we have many of these protections for the minority. That's what the Senate really is. The filibuster proved to be a very important development to protect the minority, but it forces compromises. And that's exactly what many don't want to hear. In my book, I talk about one Harvard professor who I debated, who sort of said the quiet part out loud and said, here's how we have to radically change government so that, quote, Republicans will never win again. But he said, we first have to get hold of the Supreme Court and change it because it will never allow these things to occur. Well, that really is what we're talking about here. That is, right. You have many on the left who want substantial changes on our 250th anniversary of the system that brought us here.
And there's, see, what the president always says, and I'm not for this, is, well, we should change the filibuster because as soon as they take power, they're going to do it. So let's just go ahead of it. And but the thing is, as you know, Jonathan, better than anybody, is that if we watch now the Republicans, House and Senate, get rid of the filibuster and just change things, we're going to have whiplash when Democrats gain power because they're just going to change it right back.
Well, this is going to be a test of principle for the Democrats. My understanding is that Democratic senators have told their colleagues that they will hold the line and preserve the filibuster. And we'll
see. Why should we believe them now when it was only Sinema and Manchin that stopped them before?
That's exactly right. And that is the concern. But it is worth keeping in mind that the more we get into these types of direct democracy methods, it creates greater instability for us. And you're going to see much of this agenda carried out. And we're going to need those things. You know, in Rage in the Republic, I talk about the combination of robotics and AI and the fact that we're going to lose a lot of jobs. And it's going to be a real stress test for the system. This book makes a strong case for capitalism. I believe capitalism is the solution here. And it reminds people that this is our 250th anniversary, not just of the revolution, but the publication of Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. And that book was not a great hit in Europe. It was a great hit here. The founders immediately recognized that his economic theory was the perfect companion of their political theory, because we had the first Enlightenment revolution. But they knew that there could be no liberty unless people were economically independent. So what I write about in the book is we have to avoid what's coming, which is a large population of unemployed, unproductive citizens subsidized by the government. Because we cannot have a kept citizenry and keep this republic.
Right. And people talk about a basic income. So we have to find a way, you know, find a way. People say, well, AI is different. I don't know if you can make that comparison. I don't know if I bought into it yet. But, you know, when we were selling horses and cars come in and it destroyed horse sales. If you're a blacksmith, your business is going to drop pretty significantly. In comes the computer and things change. And I'm sure a lot of accountants lost their jobs. You know, and then I'm sure TurboTax hurt a lot of other people that a lot of other accountants. So the progress is made. Society's got to adjust. But let me ask you something. What could you do in terms of getting Wealth of Nations into schools? What could you, and how do you convince Democrats that that's important? Is it possible?
Well, you know, the Rage in the Republic talks about the increased support for socialism and communism, particularly among younger people. And these are people who never saw or experienced the collapse of socialist governments in the 20th century. All they have are these sound bites from people like Mondami, who I talk about in the book, introducing them to the, quote, warmth of collectivism. These are lines that came right out of that period. I talk about when Mitterrand was elected the socialist leader of France. He actually appointed a minister of leisure, telling the public that he was going to have someone help them with all of the leisure they would have in a socialist nation. And of course, the economy collapsed. But we don't have to wait for that, right? And I am a big fan of Trump accounts. I think it's brilliant. Because it's going to show young people that investment and savings can make you truly independent. That if you want to be free, You've got to be economically free. You can't be part of a kept citizenry.
That is such a great point. And I just think that it's so hard to tell everybody at once from 12 to 70, we're getting off course. And what course you take it about? And socialism is not going to work. Some people are convinced, but I just think somehow changing the education system, not to be conservative, not to be liberal, but to be pro-American without being propaganda. I just don't know why it's in our interests for either party to not have U.S. history written about in a positive way. It's the most positive story you could write. Just tell it as it is. Don't spin it and don't ignore it. And don't ignore it, number one. And number two, don't write it wrong. You're writing it backwards. You embrace something like the 1619 Project, and it's so hard to get that out of schools. But it's hard to get back in the other texts, the other history books that we used to have.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, ultimately, you know, Rage in the Republic is optimistic. I mean, I think the book, I know the book, believes that we will survive this century and thrive, but only if we can answer a question that was raised by a French writer at the beginning of our republic. Because Europe was fascinated by us. We seemed to be like a new species to them. Because remember, we had nothing in common. We didn't have any history, culture, religion that really bound everyone. We had a legacy of ideas, and it fascinated Europe. And so this French writer wrote this question that I talk about in the book a lot, which is, what then is this America? And it's an incredibly profound question at the time and still is. We need to understand, if we're going to face the challenges ahead, and they are immense, we're going to have to understand, who then is this American? Who were we and who are we now? If we can answer that question, we'll flourish in this century, because these are revolutionary times, but we are a revolutionary people.
And that was it. When Thomas Jefferson, I think people misinterpret, but you're the expert. People misinterpret. Jefferson said it was good every once in a while to spill some blood and have a revolution, and to paraphrase what he wanted. I don't think he really thinks that we should be shooting each other in the streets to change laws, especially him. He was somebody who wouldn't even form a militia when asked during the revolution.
No, that's right. You know, our unique republic is the product of so many geniuses, including Jefferson. But I focus on Thomas Paine, who was sort of the righteous
rage.
Common
sense.
He knew what it would take to move a people to revolution. But James Madison knew what it would take to move a revolution into a republic. It was the combination of those two figures that captures this unique quality about the American Republic.
And we had to change after we won the war from the Articles of Confederation were not working. And we had to come up with a constitution. So even after we win the war, we went almost from that into a crisis, which we stood up and we solved that crisis. And we're not at that point now, but it's good to recognize it early. And you outline it in your book. It's called Rage in the Republic. Pick it up. Jonathan, I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you, my friend.
Jonathan Turley, back in a moment.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm trying to get as many reps as I can, and actually I started taking on boxing. The truth really comes out in the congressional gym.
Tell me.
Republicans and Democrats work out together. That's where I see who they really are.
Huh.
It's quite frustrating because, you know, the that they talk about the president and knowing that what he's doing is wrong.
Like what? That is Eric Swalwell, who, by the way, you know what they found out? That he spent $200,000 plus on childcare. But okay, that's interesting. Except for he charged his campaign paid for it. Should his campaign be paying for childcare? Are you kidding? Babysitting? Isn't that a blatant violation?
I mean, I think probably if we dug into it, the dirty secret is that most politicians use campaign funds for stuff like that, but I'm not an expert on it. But I also think his point on being in the gym, everyone's talk. When you're in Washington, everyone talks very freely off the record. This is nothing new. Democrats do it too. It's That's why they're politicians.
Right. Yeah, some people, I heard that so much in the first term, especially, oh, they don't like Trump, they're afraid of him, but they're afraid to say this or that. I mean, do you think anyone in the gym ever said, hey, Joe Biden seems to be in a coma every day? I haven't seen him. I called him. He doesn't remember my name. He looked me in the eye. Didn't know who I was. Right? You don't think that was ever said in the gym? You think that came up when he was lacing up the gloves?
Well, just wasn't looking for the cameras when that was being said.
Absolutely. There's no way they're going to make him governor. Do you realize he thought he could be president? The only thing crazy is that de Blasio thought he could be president. I mean, at some point, someone's telling him things that are so off base. It's insane. Rod Woodson's coming up next. If you want to talk about this game for Super Bowl 60, he's one of the best in the business. Don't move.
Is 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. And by the way, Sunday Super Bowl 60, we're going to be live at right after the game. I'll be on the 10 o'clock with One Nation live at right after the Super Bowl. I can't roll any highlights till the game's over. The game we looked at, it ends at like 10-10 roughly if there's no overtime. I got to wait for the trophies to be done. But afterwards, we'll be able to recap the game, the halftime show, all the preliminaries. I mean, I think their pregame show starts at 9 a.m. And I've been at I've covered 27 Super Bowls, but I'm not going to be in San Francisco. The 3 hour time difference too in the morning show just doesn't work. But we know I got two intriguing, nobody predicted matchups. Seattle against New England. You got Robert Kraft back, brings his team back. The guy knows how to run a business. And he brings his team back after 4 wins the previous year. And Seattle never really had too many down years. They reloaded, rebuilt, and now I think they're going to be good for a long time. A guy that was great for his entire career, one of the all-time great players, Rod Woodson, joins us now. Hall of Famer, Super Bowl champ with the Pittsburgh Steelers and with the Baltimore Ravens. Rod, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Brian, appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, man.
First off, before we talk about the Super Bowl, how do you feel about Mike McCarthy, head coach of your Pittsburgh Steelers?
It's going to be interesting. It's, you know, they went in a different direction. I think everybody was thinking they're going to go, and they normally go young, right? When they got Chuck Knoll, he was a younger coach. When they got Bill Cowher, he was a younger coach. When they got Mike Tomlin, he was a younger coach. And then you get McCarthy, and he's an older coach. So it's a little different than normal. I was a little surprised that they didn't go young again. But no matter what, he's going to understand the Steeler culture. You know, he's going to understand the environment that he's in. And I think he has a lot of big shoes to fill just for the fact that they want Super Bowls, you know. And I think that's, you know, Mike, when you look at Mike Tomlin the last several years, everybody's talking about, hey, Mike didn't win a lot of playoff games recently. And that's the reason that he more likely, you know, when you're a tender coach in the league, you know, when you're not living up to what the standards are in Pittsburgh, I think that's one of the reasons he walked away from it. But, you know, it's going to be fun to see how Mike does, and it's going to be fun to see who's going to be his quarterback.
So Rod, of course, played for the Steelers from 87 to 96, then the 49ers for a year. I missed that one, my bad. And then the Ravens, I remember that quite well, and finished up with the Raiders and comes out to one of the great players to ever play the game, period, and won Super Bowl 35. So, Rod, why do you think it is that the Steelers, from your vantage point, have been good, not great? I mean, and most people would take their overall record, but they haven't really been thought of as Super Bowl contenders for a while, maybe since, you know, obviously since Ben Roethlisberger retired. What do you think happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, in today's football, you need a quarterback, right? And I mean, you just said it. Ben retired, and it seemed like the Steelers retired when he retired, right? And they really never recovered. And they've been trying to replace him, got some number one draft picks at the quarterback position. I think they had some of the picks that did make there was, I think they were stretching to get a player at that position to try to fill the shoes of Ben. You know, I was hoping that they took Dart from last year's draft, and they didn't. They went defensive line instead. So, you know, they got to find that spot. Once they find that spot, I think they have they have the pieces in place to contend, especially in the AFC North.
The other thing is, do you as a player, sometimes great coaches, and Bill Parcells says 10 years, sometimes they just shut you off. We watched 18 years with Harbaugh and all those years with Mike Tomlin. He doesn't become it. They don't become bad coaches. But do you think after a while, players need to hear something different than coaches maybe need a fresh start?
No, because it's not just the coaches, right? It's the coach. He's coaching the team. He's the head coach of the team. But it's the players' team, right? This is a National Football League. These guys are making a boatload of money. And I really say the player got to take more ownership if you want to be great. And when your coaches can talk about doing certain things, but the players have to police the locker room. And if they can police that locker room, which they normally do in Pittsburgh and they normally do in Baltimore, they've been doing it in San Francisco for a while. And, you know, they're trying to find that culture again with the Raiders when I played there at the end. But, you know, I think the players have to take ownership of being a part of the team because they're making a lot of money nowadays and they have to be leaders inside that locker room.
I want to talk about the Super Bowl, but I also want to talk about what you're doing because we talk about this on the show all the time. You are now joining with the DEA's mission to make it a fentanyl-free America campaign, which I think is so different about fentanyl is, you know, when we watch people get hooked on coke and decide they drink too much and you go, well, they went down the wrong path. They're born with it or they're born an addictive personality. That's not this debate. This debate is one and done. You know, there's people that are addicts and do fentanyl and die. I got you. But what people don't understand is what makes this so insidious, if they slip fentanyl into something you have no idea about, whether it's Adderall to stay up and study or it's something else that you would hope that maybe helps you focus, then you end up dead. I think that's what's so insidious about this. We know it comes from China, and then it's mixed. The precursors come from China. It's mixed in Mexico, and it floods our border.
Yeah, you know, Brian, first of all, it's personal for me. I don't care where it comes from. You know, fentanyl does not discriminate. The one thing I want to get across to these young individuals out there in this world, you can't get prescription drugs on social media platforms. You just can't. You know, so go through the right channels because, listen, 2 millimeters of fentanyl is going to kill you. And that's just like a pin drop. The tip of a pin. And, you know, the one thing that the DEA and NFL Alumni Health partnered up for the last 3 years to come here to the Super Bowl to speak on this. And they've done, listen, DEA has done a tremendous job. You know, you think about what they have done over the last year. And
oh, my goodness.
Fentanyl, yeah. In 2024, it killed 50,000 people, but it was down 29%. From 73,000 people who died in 2023. So they're doing everything in the right manner. Our biggest thing is, hey, listen, make sure that these young kids are understanding that fentanyl can be put into anything. It can look like a prescription drug. You cannot buy prescription drugs on a social media platforms. We're just like that. I'm just want to ring that out to this new generation who stands with their phones in their hands 18 hours out of the 24, you know, that's out there on a given day. The people are just on their phones all the time. And we just want to make sure that they understand that you cannot get the prescription drugs on a social media platform, and making sure that you go through the right channels. If you do have issues, going through the right channels through your prescribed doctor, your physicians, then making sure you get the right prescriptions if needed.
Why is it personal for you?
Personal for me, my oldest son has some drug issues, but it was kind of before the fentanyl thing became like an into thing here in the U.S. So it was way back in the early 90s. So I just want to make sure that kids who have those issues, who are running and not really knowing where they want to go and where they're, you know, what they want to do in their life, that, you know, they're not going down that same path. And the good thing is that, you know, my son is fine and great today. But if he was in today's market, it could have been one of those pills and it could have killed him.
Absolutely. And Rod, on the fun stuff again, we got a matchup, Seattle against New England. And we have Drake May, 23 years old. And then you have Sam Darnold, who's been through so much in his career as the number two pick overall, number one of the Jets, then over to Carolina, then to San Francisco, then to Minnesota, and then Seattle, ends up in the Super Bowl. But I want to talk about Drake May. Here's what how Troy Aikman, who knows a thing or two about good quarterbacks, said about the 23-year-old. Cut 35.
I remember when we beat San Francisco in the NFC Championship game, we were underdogs going into that one. A lot of people did not expect us to win. Probably a little bit like New England. But once you win that game, you go in the locker room, and especially for a quarterback, you realize that as great as this win is, and now we're going to the Super Bowl, none of it matters unless you actually win the Super Bowl. Nobody really remembers much about the teams that lose. And so I'm sure that crossed his mind as soon as he was traveling back to New England after that win at Denver. Over the years, I've had quarterbacks reach out to me and say, hey, how did you approach the week of the Super Bowl? And what I tried to do and what I tell them is try to make it as normal as you possibly can. And it's hard to do because you've got media obligations, you're staying in a hotel. There's a lot of distractions, as you well know, but if you can get the support of the organization, as I did, and kind of make your hotel situation as much like what you had at home, then I think the better off you are.
I guess he should be all ears, being a young quarterback like he is. Your thoughts about Troy's advice?
No, I mean, it's we all say try to make it as normal as possible, right?
But it's not.
It's not. It's not. It's just not. I mean, I played in three Super Bowls, right? You only mentioned the one I won, right? And so people don't remember second place. You just, not in the National Football League. Nobody remembers a second best team year in and year out. Nobody remembers that. So yeah, it is, it's a big deal. It's became bigger and bigger and bigger. Probably one of the biggest events that happens in sports throughout the year, right? The game day. But the week leading up to it, all your family getting tickets, you know, coming into the area, doing media obligations every single day throughout the week. That's not normal. Yeah, I mean, you have to do that in your own locker room when you're sleeping in your own bed during the regular season. But it's not a normal case, you know. So, and for a young player who's played the way that Drake May has played, I think he's played solid football. He hasn't played great since in the postseason, given having up 15 sacks, 4 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. It's the sacks that concern me. So I think it's going to be an interesting game. But to hear Troy say to try to make it as normal as possible, and I know we all say that to young players, but that is really, really hard to do.
All right, so you're a defensive back. You're playing against Drake May. When you put in the tape to study it, for people that didn't play in the NFL, what are you looking for? This quarterback, you might not have seen much of him, AFC, NFC. What are you looking for over these next 2 weeks of his past games to try to edge?
I'm getting a real good feel for when he likes to throw, when he's dropping in his drop, is he looking to his right when he puts his back foot in the ground, when he hitches back up into the pocket, is he then when he turns to look, is that his normal throwing place? Is that his place he's going to go to? And then also you got to figure out who Josh McDaniels is, because he's only going to run the plays that Josh McDaniels like to run in certain situations, right? Situational football, we call
it. That's the offensive coordinator.
So Josh McDaniels, I'm going to study what he likes to do in critical moments. And then at the end of the day, it is football. So we have, as believers, and we always say defensive players, self-doubt kills you. And you have to believe when you put your foot in the ground, you just got to go. If you're going in the wrong direction, as long as you're going 100 miles an hour, sometimes good things happen to you. But, you know, I think for Drake May, you know, the one thing that I would try to do for him since he's so young is to give him a lot of different looks, but do something else.
And if you can do that and make him
think about what he's doing once he's dropping with the football. And if you can do that, the advantage should go to the Seattle Seahawks defense.
So, for example, New England knows you're studying them. So how much change are they making? What kind of disguise can you put in 2 weeks to really throw a guy like you off, Rod Woodson?
You know, what they'll do is that football, especially offensively, it's a formation-driven system, right? So they're going to run so many formations. Forget the personnel groupings, because if a tight end is sitting over there by himself, he's still the X. Even though he's technically the tight end, but he's still the X receiver. So he's the X receiver means he's the receiver all by himself on one side of the ball. Everybody else is the other positions. So once they move those pieces around and they come to a final formation, most offenses in the National Football League only run about 6 to 7 plays outside of that. And it becomes down to what situation it is. Is it first and 10? Is it first and 15? Is it first and 20? You know, you always see in first and long or third and long, teams either going to run a screen or a draw, right? That's normal. That's what everybody does in the National Football League. Third and short, everybody runs man-to-man on defense, and most teams run some type of either motion or we call mesh routes, which are crossing routes, shallow crossing routes, to try to get somebody rubbed off. Everybody does it. It's so if you start noticing that and you start noticing little patterns of when Josh McDaniels was going to call certain things inside of a game. And then Josh is going to study the defense for the Seattle Seahawks. When do they like to pressure? When do they like to get to an odd front? When did they like to get to an even front? So it's, I think it's a good chess match. But, you know, I'm a fan of older players trying to get their due. So I got a lot of love for Sam Darnold.
Yep.
Who struggled early. But he found his, I think he found his path when he had that 1 year in San Francisco and he got to be a Kyle Shanahan for a whole year. And it seems like it said, oh, it's just football. And he goes off and he plays at a high level from there on out. And so that's that. I think that was really refreshing. And I think it'd be wonderful to see that type of path for him to get a Super Bowl, saying, okay, it doesn't start normally the way everybody wants him. Everybody's calling him a bust, whatever that is. But he fought through it, and he can become the Super Bowl champ if he wins this football game.
Yeah, I guess the mindset is, I'm brought to San Francisco as a backup, so there's no pressure on me. I asked to step up, and he played really well. But you also could learn, and he says, what do I have to lose? And then when he gets his chance in Minnesota, he does great. And then he finally gets a team that was willing to invest in him, and he does better. Rod Woodson, great talking to you. I love your cause. It's definitely one in which our audience can relate to. We always talk about the dangers of fentanyl. It's the DEA's Fentanyl Free America campaign. The Hall of Famer, Rod Woodson, a part of his Super Bowl champ. Thanks, Rod.
Brian, I appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Madam Vice President, what's going on with Kamala HQ?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I have good news. So Kamala HQ is turning into headquarters, and it's where you can go online to get basically the latest of what's going on, and also to meet and revisit with some of our great courageous leaders, be they elected leaders, community leaders, civic leaders, faith leaders, young leaders. I'm really excited about it. So stay engaged, and I'll see you out there. Thank you.
This is so phony. This was the big Kamala Harris announcement. So it's going to be Kamala HQ, where she's going to interview people and make announcements that matter to people that like her, Democrats, issues, go against Trump. This is the big announcement. This is the thing you tease out. And that's how you do it. So tilted, so stilted, so awkward. Can she do anything naturally?
She cannot. So Mary Catherine Hamm tweeted out, if there's one thing the world is clamoring for, it's more of Harris and her digital alum. But the other part of it, Brian, she changed her handle. So it's at headquarters _67, you know, like all the kids with the 6-7. So then Chris Rufo tweeted out, my children had informed me that 6-7 is already old, tired, and cringe. So once again, Kamala is coming up short. Just like everything she tries to do is just painful.
And seeing what is possible unburdened by what has been.
Thank you, Eric. This is what's going to stay in my head all day now. The last cut you play. Brian Kilmeade, don't forget, I'll see you in Fort Myers on the 14th, and then May 30th, I'll be out in Reno, Nevada. History, Liberty, and Laughs streamed on Fox Nation. BrianKilmeade.com. Don't move. Keep it here.